Critical energy infrastructure in the Middle East was hit this week as the Iran war drags on for 3 weeks now. Have we settled into a kind of stalemate where the US bombs Iran and assassinates leaders but can't overthrow the regime while Iran closes the Strait of Hormuz and threatens energy prices? Meanwhile, some in the Trump administration are turning against the war. Are we heading for a split in MAGA? And we'll take a closer look at how Russia is supporting Iran on today's Trumpet World. While the Iran war and related conflicts continue to be the most significant event in the news, to get the latest on how it's developing, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, the big story in the Middle East is that there are more shocks happening to the global energy system and supply. Aside from the continued blocking of the Strait of Hormuz and President Trump trying to coax allies to help guarantee safe passage through the strait, there have been more attacks, both by Iran and Iran's enemies, on major fossil fuel infrastructure. On Wednesday, Israel struck Iran's South Pars gas field. That's a maritime natural gas field that Iran shares with Qatar. The vast majority of its natural gas revenue comes from that one field. President Trump originally said that there was a complete surprise, and then he backtracked saying that, yeah, he tried to talk them out of it, but they went ahead anyway. But this not only puts a strain on Israel, but it also puts a strain on Qatar, not just because they shared the gas field, but Iran retaliated by striking Qatar's main gas processing plant in the area. That, in turn, first off, the actual damage done to the structure, they're estimating it could take about 5 years to repair, and Qatar is one of the world's largest natural gas exporters. And because of that, Qatar has had to cancel some newly signed long-term contracts with countries like Belgium, Italy, I believe China was on that list as well. As far as Europe is concerned, Qatar was their source of trying to wean themselves off of Russian natural gas, and now that's off the table now too. So you can see there's a lot of strain from this one area happening all over the place. On Thursday, Iran meanwhile struck another Saudi Arabian refinery and made a large missile attack on Riyadh, Saudi Arabia's capital, which is obviously nowhere near the Persian Gulf. It's in the middle of the Arabian Desert, while there was a conference of diplomats happening at the same time. Saudi Arabia threatened that if Iran keeps this up, that they're going to get actively involved and start attacking Iranian assets as well. So we're seeing more expansion of the scope of the war, as well as the oil and natural gas and the system that, and our economic system that relies on that, being the main targets and casualties.
That's a good point about all of the related ramifications. I think you and I were talking about this prior to last week's show, where you were making the point about how much fertilizer comes from this region. I mean, perhaps you'd like to repeat some of that on air, as it's just one example of all of the different ramifications from this.
Yes, according to some estimates, about a third of the United States' fertilizer for its domestic agricultural production comes from Persian Gulf nations. And there's actually a lot of discussion on whether because of this war we're actually going to have a stunted growing season in the United States itself because of that, which of course affects food supply, as if distributing essential goods because of the oil attacks hasn't already become that much more expensive. The previous host of our predecessor program, Mr. Philip Nice, he'd often say in these circumstances that everything around you comes from a port somewhere. It was shipped to this country to get this part, then shipped to this country for packaging, etc., etc., etc. But there are a few parts of the world that I think are more vital to our global supply chain system, to our globalized economic system, than the Persian Gulf. And whether it's energy prices in Belgium or farming in America's heartland, everything is getting affected by this.
You're right that there's just a lot of potential knock-on effects. I think we're all pretty familiar with the idea that the cost of fuel impacts almost everything. You know, like whether it's a loaf of bread, well, the farmer going out and planting those seeds, he's driving his tractor, that's going to affect his costs. It's then got to be put in a truck and taken to some kind of processing plant. Then that plant is going to run on electricity that is going to largely, the cost of which is going to be very dependent on natural gas prices. It'll be put on other trucks. It will be made into loaves of bread. It'll be distributed throughout all of the supermarkets. Fuel very quickly leads to general inflation, but then it affects so many other things. You know, there's the fertilizer point. You then have a lot of very energy intensive infrastructure that's set up in this area, not just fertilizer, aluminium, for example, bauxite processing to turn that into aluminium. There's a lot of that that goes on in the Persian Gulf because they can get cheap energy resources. There's even AI data centers setting up there. So having the Strait of Hormuz closed, it has a whole host of different knock-on effects. And you see this even in the UK, where the Bank of England just kept interest rates the same. But in terms of what people expect, before the Iran war, people were expecting interest rates to be cut by about 0.5% by the end of the year. Now they're expecting interest rates to rise by about 0.5% by the end of the year. So you're looking at people paying 1% more on their mortgages, for example, than they would have done without the war. You're looking at national debt, the government having to pay 1% more on its debt. That's potentially billions. So this is affecting wallets very directly in quite a wide range of ways. Right, so this has very wide-ranging economic implications. And what really stood out to me is, for years we've talked about that a global financial crisis is coming. And this really exposes how fragile the financial system is. It's not to say that this will cause that crash, though it definitely could. I would not take it for granted that it won't. But it's just one way. You know, 3-4 weeks ago, this was not news. And then, boom, it blew up. And then what else could blow up? We saw the Ukraine war and the massive economic impacts that had on what that did to natural gas prices and fertilizer prices and inflation and to interest rates. I mean, the global economic system, it's fragile. It is susceptible for shocks like the 2008 financial crisis, where it's something more going on with banks and ability to lend and willingness to lend to each other. And that absolutely could cause the coming global financial crisis. Everything is fragile based on kind of those different economic parts of things as well. We live in a system that is built on debt, that's built on greed. It is unsustainable. It is going to blow up at some point. We don't know when, but it would collapse on it on its own from those standpoints. But it could also all blow up from choke points coming under attack and being cut off and oil prices spiking and all of the ramifications of that. And Jesus Christ said, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars," in Matthew 24. In this end time, there's going to be violence and wars breaking out all over the place. And those wars have massive global economic implications. So, you know, we need to watch these. Could this cause the kind of global financial crisis that we've talked about that's really going to force Europe to come together with 10 kings and a strong leader? Absolutely, it could. It could develop that way. But if not, we still live in a really fragile world where there's a whole range of different things that could cause that. And that crisis could happen at any moment. And so that reminded me of this article that Mr. Robert Morley had coming up to 20 years now, Stormproof Your Financial House. Just a really practical article that goes through specific, you know, physical things, reducing your debt, increasing your saving, but also things about mindset and your spiritual life that you can do to prepare for the kind of coming global financial crisis and to prepare for what is to come. So we can put a link to that in the show notes. That's Stormproof Your Financial House. But I think that's an important takeaway from what we've seen with these different financial developments this week.
And if I could interject, one other thing that the global financial system is heavily founded on is confidence and trust. That you were mentioning that if the Strait of Hormuz were to be opened up, then the ships will finally get through there. I mean, the Red Sea, the Houthis haven't even joined Iran in attacking in this round. They haven't actually been attacking merchant shipping in general for quite a while now, and there are still major shipping companies that do not want to send their ships through that because they're afraid that, well, what if something does go wrong? We've shown that the system isn't foolproof. We don't trust these guys. So even if the Strait of Hormuz does open up, it's going to take time for shippers to even have the confidence to go through there again in the first place. And that is, however long that takes, that's still going to cause many ruptures in the system.
While we're on this subject, let's go to our US correspondent, Andrew Miller, and get his view from the United States on the economic implications of this war.
Well, there's no doubt about it that this war is going to slow down economic growth in the United States and around the world. Already here in the United States, even with President Trump releasing over 170 million barrels from our strategic petroleum reserves, gasoline prices are up about a dollar. Which means the Americans, like when you go to the pump, you're going to be spending almost half over again, whatever you were spending before, just to get where you're going to go. But maybe even more significant than that is everything you buy at a grocery store in the United States, or pretty much everything, gets there on a semi-truck, which also runs on gasoline. So if gasoline prices go up, the cost of shipping food and other things to grocery stores go up. And so you're going to get inflation all around. Right now, economists have really looked at this from the different angles, and they're basically trying to figure out, is the slowdown in economic growth going to be enough to push the nation into recession? And right now, the latest data from the Wall Street Journal is predicting that global oil prices would need to rise to $138 a barrel for a period of at least 3 weeks for that to happen. Right now, global oil prices, I think they were $119 this morning, so they're still about $20 below that point where they think it's going to tip into recession. But that definitely could change. Like you said earlier, we don't know how long this shutdown of Hormuz is going to last. We don't know if it's going to last long enough that we'll burn through our strategic oil reserves. That's why you've got members of, or former members of Congress, like former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who's advising Donald Trump, and we don't know if he'll take his advice or not. But he's saying that he's like, our number one priority in the war should be securing the Strait of Hormuz. He's like, once that's done, he's like, then if you want regime change, you should pivot towards dismantling the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And then only when the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is gone, could you even think about the realistic possibility of regime change. And so none of those things are done quickly. So we are still just waiting to see how much willpower the American people are going to have to actually accomplish any of these objectives. Right now, it seems like more than half of Americans are against the war. And even some of those who are for it are like for it. And they're like, yes, it would be nice if we toppled the world's largest state supporter of terrorism, but not if it actually cost me more at the gas station. And so you're definitely dealing with that as well. But it definitely it highlights just how powerful a weapon this is. Mr. Gerald Flurry has highlighted for a long time that when Iran does eventually push at a German-led European Union, the King of the South pushing at the King of the North, like it talks about in Daniel 11, he said that push will revolve mainly over Jerusalem, but oil will probably be like one of its top weapons it's using. And so now we're definitely seeing that as like, so far, nothing Iran's done has affected the wider world outside the Middle East that much. But now they're definitely flexing their control over the Strait of Hormuz, showing just how much damage they can do to the wider world. And this is something that, this isn't going to be the last time Iran uses this weapon. They're going to use this same strategy again in a future war with Europe. And now we're starting to see kind of like a dress rehearsal of just why Europe's going to have to use such decisive force to deal with this regime. Because, like I said, if you can shut down a strait for 3 weeks and cause a global recession, that's a threat that has to be dealt with decisively at some point.
It's a good point. And related to that, the question I've seen a lot of people talk about is, well, what happens when the Houthis get involved, or if the Houthis get involved, where they're set up right on the Red Sea, and you've got the potential, like some of these countries like Saudi Arabia can export a limited amount of oil via the Red Sea. It's still an important shipping lane. They have been taking pot shots for a while now, but there's still some shipping able to go through there. If the Houthis really went ballistic, pardon the pun, I guess, that this could make the situation a whole lot worse. Now, it does seem that Iran is kind of holding back because they want to encourage America and Israel to hold back and not go all out against them. But just like you were saying, Andrew, you know, Mr. Flurry's talked about the way that Iran will use these sea lanes to push at Europe. I mentioned the Daniel 11 mentions Egypt and Ethiopia, both being part of this Iranian alliance. Ultimately, Egypt's not there yet. Ethiopia's in a bit of chaos. You've got the Houthis set up in that area. And once that happens, they can completely shut down the Red Sea and start, you know, you've got Egypt, and then it talks about Libya as well, start taking action on the Mediterranean Sea. So you see Iran beginning a strategy now that they're going to use to great effect against Europe. So, I mean, this resource for, we don't know how bad it's going to get right now. I did mention, I think, that article, Stormproof Your Financial House, that sooner or later things are going to get bad. And that is a great, very practical article from Mr. Morley, nearly 20 years old now, on just physical and spiritual steps to take to prepare for what is coming. But this strategy is really going to develop a whole lot further. And potentially you could see something like this. I mean, who's to say that what is happening right now wouldn't escalate to the point that it leads to this financial collapse that we've been talking about, and leads to then this collapse that changes the world and forces Europe to come together as a 10-nation superpower. But the financial implications are well worth watching. I think, Mihailo, another important aspect of this that's worth watching that you've highlighted is Israel's war in Lebanon, which I think in the popular imagination has been overshadowed quite a lot. You know, we tend to focus Strait of Hormuz bombing campaign. That's what I see the most headlines about. But you mentioned there have been some important developments in Lebanon this week as well.
Yes, Israel escalated its war with Hezbollah by starting a formal ground invasion on Sunday. This was basically a repeat of what they did in 2024 when they came in to dismantle Hezbollah's infrastructure, held actual battles with Hezbollah. That's basically what's going on right now. There are a few very noteworthy details about this that I think differentiate what happened back then with what happened now. For start, I could be wrong about this, but if memory serves me right, we didn't see as much of nearly of a displacement of the Lebanese people when Israel went in last time. There were certainly people moving around, but according to some estimates, about 1 million people, or 20% of Lebanon's total population, have now been displaced just with Israeli warnings saying, we're going to come in here soon. You better leave if you know what's good for you. And I mean, for a small country like Lebanon, geographically, to have 1 million people internally displaced, moved around, Lebanon's poor, they can't necessarily handle that much. But also, the Lebanese government has taken some interesting steps that I believe we may have covered before on this program, of basically trying to dismantle Hezbollah, telling them that they need to stand down, that they need to, that Hezbollah's military activities are banned. The Lebanese government is much more weaker than Hezbollah. They try not to get involved in these fights, but they've been at least putting up a lot more rhetoric. They don't necessarily like that Israel's invading at the same time, but at least according to a report by Axios, they have reached out to France to try and mediate between the two sides. And France is apparently working on a, as part of this, a peace deal between the Lebanese government and Israel. I'll believe it when I see it, when that actually comes to fruition. But the very fact that that's on the table at this point, and that the Lebanese government is apparently willing to consider it, I think goes to show, A, how much they've been fed up with Hezbollah dragging them into these wars. Israel wouldn't be warring in Lebanon if it weren't for Hezbollah and their fanatical missions. And B, just how much, well, if this is the drips and drabs that we're getting of Hezbollah or of the Lebanese government and Israel right now, what discussions are going on behind the scenes that the news media hasn't even been able to get a whiff of yet? So certainly some very important turning points happening in Lebanon right now.
And I think, okay, it's obvious why we're paying attention to, like, we personally are impacted by what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we're having to pay more for our gas and affected by all the financial implications. Why are we paying some attention to Lebanon?
Well, I spoke on this program before about how the Arab world is turning against Iran because of its strikes, because of the strikes like the ones I mentioned earlier in the program against Qatar, against Saudi Arabia, against all these Gulf states. And that factors into a prophecy in Psalm 83, which speaks of an alliance formed by these various Middle Eastern peoples that history, both in the Bible and in secular records, says has never happened. That's why Mr. Fleury, in his free book, The King of the South, says that this is a prophecy for now. And back then, I focused on the Ishmaelites being mentioned in that prophecy, though that would equate the Peninsular Arabs, the Saudis, the Gulf states. But Gebal and Tyre are also mentioned. And those are both Phoenician city-states. And what is today Lebanon? They're city-states right now. They're still major urban centers in Lebanon today. Tyre at the south is one of Hezbollah's strongholds, and Gebal or Byblos in the north is more in a Sunni Christian area. So this is saying all of Lebanon, which has a very diverse population from north to south, is going to be involved in this alliance too, which, as Mr. Fleury elaborates in his book, is also an anti-Iranian alliance. To this point, Hezbollah is basically a carbon copy of the IRGC. They are trying to do in Lebanon what Iran or what the revolution did in Iran decades ago. That's their whole purpose for existence, that and fighting against Israel. So for a long time, we've expected Hezbollah to be uprooted and for it to take on a more westward, you could say, more European direction versus Eitmensen's Asher or Germany being involved in this alliance as well. And when the last war happened in 2024, we said that this is helping fulfill this prophecy, but the prophecy wasn't complete. Hezbollah was able to rebuild its capabilities. The Lebanese government was too afraid to come and force them to get out of the country. And now we're seeing Israel come and do the Lebanese government's job for it again. And the Lebanese government is being way more supportive of it this time than it was the last time. And you're even seeing, again, France get involved, even potentially writing a peace treaty between Israel and Lebanon. So even when we don't know exactly how this war is going to end, like we didn't know exactly how the last war is going to end, we could already see major moves in bringing Lebanon into this anti-Iranian alliance as well.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Well, we'll shift gears in just a second and talk more about some major developments on how the U.S. is prosecuting and viewing that war. Before we do so, is there anything else that's worth bringing to us from the last week, Mihailo, from the Middle East?
One story, and I think it's a good segue into Andrew's section. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent said that the U.S. is considering lifting sanctions on Iranian oil that's already out at sea just to combat the price increase that we're seeing everywhere. They've already done a similar move with Russian oil that's already out at sea. Again, the oil prices are impacting everything everywhere in the world, and you can understand why the government is trying to do whatever it could to lower prices. But at the same time, unsanctioning the economic lifeline of the enemy that now they're trying to destroy gives a little sense of desperation to me from the government, both in calming the oil market down, but also just trying to figure out what's next in this war. And if they're already saying they're considering allowing Iran to trade its oil without sanctions. That is, what are they talking about with the war itself, and how they're, and if they're planning on dying that down, and what their plan is for the future? It suggests to me that they don't really have that much of a plan, and they're trying to figure one to end it as quickly as possible.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. This week, we had a pretty dramatic resignation in the U.S. government, with now Israel being blamed more strongly than ever for pushing America into a war that it doesn't want and is not in its interest. To get the latest on this story, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's definitely a growing split, even in the conservative movement in America, over the war on Iran. I think one of the keys to understanding American electoral politics, especially for like those internationally who might not be as familiar with it, is that the evangelical Christian population in America for decades has overwhelmingly supported the state of Israel and voted Republican. The secularist movement, like the leftist movements in America, generally oppose the state of Israel and vote Democrat. And there, our swing vote, and the vote that almost every election determines who wins, the Republican or a Democrat, is the Catholic vote. They swing back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, and usually if you know who the Catholics vote for, you know who's going to win the election. So now Pope Leo in Rome and Cardinal Pizzaballa in Jerusalem and Bishop McElroy in Washington, D.C., have all condemned this as an unjust war, saying that there wasn't an imminent threat that justifies America going to war with Iran. Therefore, America needs to withdraw from this war as soon as possible. And so this has turned quite a few conservative Americans, especially Roman Catholics, against this war. I think one of the higher profile ones this week was the head of the U.S. Counterterrorism Center, Joe Kent. He resigned earlier this week. Guy went on Tucker Carlson's podcast yesterday to talk about why he resigned, and spoke at a Catholics for Catholics rally last night about why he resigned. And I haven't actually seen what he said at the Catholics for Catholics rally yet. That hasn't received as much news coverage. But I did read his resignation letter, and I did see at least significant portions of his interview with Tucker Carlson. And he's basically, well, he's adopted two, what I'd characterize as conspiracy theories. The first that are, which is false, and then the second, which is probably just disingenuous. The first thing he's talking about is basically the same thing the Pope and Pizzaballa and Cardinal McElroy is saying, that there's no evidence Iran was developing a nuclear bomb. Iran posed no imminent threat to America. This is an unjust war. The second point he made, which is actually the more disturbing one, echoing some comments that another Catholic podcaster in America, Candace Owens, has been saying, is basically inferring that Israel had something to do with Charlie Kirk's assassination. He said that, oh, Charlie Kirk, a popular religious leader in the United States who was assassinated by an Antifa radical last year, basically saying that Charlie Kirk, because he was against a large-scale invasion of Iran, that somehow, he said, we need to, he didn't definitively say that Israel killed him, but he said there's something like we definitely need to be investigating is Israel's ties to the Charlie Kirk assassination. And then he didn't give any proof or evidence that there are any Israel ties to the proof of investigation. He says, well, he said the Trump administration's just against looking into it. So it's, and I think that comment is what's got him more roundly criticized as just an overt anti-Semite throwing out conspiracies similar to conspiracies that have been used in the past, protocols of Elders of Zion, and how the Jews are really behind this or the Jews are really behind that. And I don't know how many Americans he speaks for when he's saying that Israel assassinated Charlie Kirk. I certainly hope there's not many Americans who buy into that level of anti-Semitic nonsense. But I do think he speaks for quite a few when he's saying that, like, even though Iran is actively stockpiling weapons-grade uranium, he says they don't have a nuclear program. And even though Iran is the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism, who has already killed 1,000 Americans since the start of the revolution, he claims there's not an imminent threat. So these are claims. The fact that Iran's not an imminent threat to America, it's like, well, tell that to the families of the 1,000 people they've already killed, is something that people should be able to see through. But I think because he's actually got the support of the Pope and some prominent cardinals and some prominent podcasters like Tucker Carlson, you are seeing more and more Americans, conservative Americans, especially those conservative Americans who aren't evangelical Christians, saying that, like, we need to pull out of this war with Iran as soon as possible, because this war is the result of Israeli aggression, and Iran really isn't a threat to the United States at all.
It is an odd one, the idea that that Israel would go around assassinating anyone who's critical of Israel, given that so many people are critical of Israel and have not been assassinated. That is quite unusual. Do you have any sense of... No, that's a good point. I mean, there was a quote where he at the time that he made it, didn't want to attack Iran. Would he have been for or against the attack right now? I don't know, maybe not, I guess, looking at that quote. But yeah, you're right. He was generally quite pro-Israel, actually. So a fairly bizarre theory. I guess opinion polls, they do tend to indicate at the moment MAGA Republicans are generally still in favor of this war, right? But I guess this does, like, this is it's a significant addition to, say, the Tucker Carlson voice. I think Kent is a much more credible mainstream figure than Tucker Carlson. At this point, I think Carlson generally appeals, at least on this subject, to a pretty fringe audience. You could see someone like Kent mainstreaming that view a lot more and potentially widening the division within MAGA as time goes on.
I think the polls I've seen indicates that MAGA support for Donald Trump's actions in Iran is in the 90%. So I think that the split within MAGA, I mean, there is a split within MAGA. I mean, Tucker Carlson is self-allegedly MAGA. But I feel like that split's probably 90-10 at worst. However, as I mentioned with that Catholic swing vote before, Donald Trump got 78 million votes in the last election, and there aren't 78 million people who claim to be MAGA. There's a lot of independents. 'Cause like you said, Joe Biden won the Catholic vote there's some electoral fraud in that election, but like he allegedly won the Catholic vote in 2020 because he is Roman Catholic. And Donald Trump is more associated with evangelical Christians, because Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were so pro-abortion, there was a big Catholic swing towards Donald Trump in the last election over the abortion issue. And so Donald Trump, he won like 60% of the Catholic vote, which is better than a president has done amongst Catholics in a long time. But that, I feel like a lot of that support was driven by just all Christians trying to unite against this abortion agenda. But there are significant foreign policy divisions between those 78 million people who voted for Donald Trump, with especially those in the evangelical movement, historically being very pro-Israel. Israel exists because Christian Zionists in Britain and America moved to allow the Jews to move back to their historic homeland. Whereas the Catholic Church, they do have diplomatic relationships with Israel now. I think they established it in 1993 or 1994. Though it is telling, at least to me, that the Catholic Church established diplomatic relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran before they did with Israel. So they've had longer diplomatic relationships with Iran than Israel, which shows that this is definitely not a clear-cut issue to them that Iran is a terrorist state attacking the principles of Western civilization. But I mainly bring that up just to show that this Joe Kent, I mean, now with especially some of these things he's saying about the Jews probably assassinated Charlie Kirk, you could dismiss him as a disgruntled former employee who's just trying to take down as many people as he can. He is under FBI investigation for leaking, so he might have other personal reasons for saying some of the things he's saying. But just because that's the case, we shouldn't definitely dismiss his viewpoints as a fringe movement or something that no one believes, because there is definitely some growing opposition in the conservative movement in America against the state of Israel. Several prominent voices, a lot of this does stem from a deeper religious divide between Christian Zionist and Roman Catholic supersessionalist and those who also follow that theology. So definitely a trend to keep watching. I mean, we definitely don't know all of how this is going to play out as to like how much Trump's going to listen to this side of his base versus the other side of his base. But as we've highlighted on this program many, many times before, Britain and America and the Jewish state of Israel in the Middle East are prophesied to be conquered by a revived Holy Roman Empire if they don't repent. Even though Barack Obama also had some very anti-Israel policies, anti-Israel enough that our editor-in-chief likened him to Antiochus in his book, America Under Attack, ultimately it's not the radical left or the Islamists in Iran that are going to take the Jews away captive. Prophetically, it's the Catholic Church and the empire, the European empire they ally with, that's the enemy of Israel that's going to have the most success in actually trying to blot out that state before the Messiah's return.
Well, that, I think, does bring us nicely to the other story, or one of the other stories you wanted to mention. Right now on our website, the main story, I think it's quite relevant to some of the resource material we were talking about, is called How to Besiege the United States of America. It's adapted from our infographic in the latest Trumpet print. And it talks about various different choke points and ways to harm America economically. But one of the key things that we've zeroed in on for how this Catholic-led Holy Roman Empire is going to besiege the United States is working with Latin America and using those Catholic links to establish strong ties to Latin America and then use that region to cut America off from world trade. And perhaps the most important single location for America's trade is Cuba, which, and Donald Trump, he seems like he's trying to do one regime change at a time, but Cuba also seems pretty close to regime change and had some quite significant developments there this week.
Yeah, I talked a couple weeks ago with a candidate for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, John Deaton, and we highlighted in that program how from the United States perspective, Cuba, Panama, and Greenland are probably the top three trade choke points. We've been talking about Hormuz so far this program, which is more important to Europe than it is to the United States. But yeah, in the United States, I mean, Panama, Cuba, and Greenland, and Cuba probably is the most important. Panama's right neck and neck with it. Greenland might be a little less. But so this is really strategic, because like half of U.S. seaborne trade comes via Cuba. And so any power that wants to besiege the United States, like the revived Holy Roman Empire is prophesied to besiege the United States, is going to need a foothold in Cuba. Now, historically, Cuba's allied with Venezuela and China and the Soviet Union and communist powers against the United States. So Donald Trump's pushing hard for regime change in Cuba. They're almost out of oil. He's had an embargo against them for months now. And only about finally this week, he said that like Cuba's in very bad shape and he wants to return his attention to it very soon. We've even had a number of people, I think there's about four people in the Trump administration who've anonymously told Axios that the Trump administration right now is demanding the resignation of Cuba's current dictator, Miguel Canel Diaz. So he's really digging in his heels because he doesn't want to resign, saying that he wants to fight against this U.S. embargo. But it really looks like he's probably going to be out of office this year, or if not, very soon afterwards. Now, a little concerning in that, like, the Trump administration, it's also been confirmed that they're working with the Vatican. The Secretary of State of the Vatican, Cardinal Parolin, has confirmed that. And I think under Vatican pressure, in an attempt to not rock the boat too much, they're not actually pushing for the overt collapse of communism in Cuba. The deals being discussed right now, which could change, but the deals being discussed right now would see the Communist Party stay in place. They'd also see the Castro family, which has deep connections to the Cuban business community, stay influential. And is mainly looking at toppling the current dictator and getting someone more moderate in. And so in the short term, that could be an outright victory. The current dictator of Cuba is very hardline anti-American. If you got a more pragmatic reformist communist who wants to take the country through a perestroika phase and open it up to Western business, that could weaken Cuba's alliance with Russia and China and some of these other socialist powers in the world. But because of the Roman Catholic involvement, it could also open a door for the European Union to get a much greater hold over Cuba, which America would probably see as a good thing because we currently consider the European Union as an ally. But prophetically, when you're looking at the Holy Roman Empire as the main force that besieges America, pushing Canel Diaz from office, but letting the Castro family remain influential, could just be pushing one American enemy out of Cuba and opening the door for another.
So that's I could see that potentially being the first story to knock Iran off as our number one item if we do see that happening soon. Anything else from the English-speaking world to bring us?
I'll just bring two more quick stories. One is the national debt crossed $39 trillion this week. So it's always going up, and I could say the national debt hit a new record every week if I wanted to. So I normally wait for when it crosses a $1 trillion mark to bring it up. I brought this up on this program about 5 months ago, when it crossed the $38 trillion mark. So the fact that it's gone from 38 to 39 trillion in 5 months and is raising by about $7 billion a day, and will probably hit $40 trillion by the time we hit midterm elections, is definitely a worrying sign. The U.S. currently spends about one-fifth of all its tax revenue just servicing the interest on the national debt. As the debt-to-GDP ratio goes up, that number's going to slowly increase as the national debt consumes a larger and larger portion of American tax revenues in the months and years going forward. But as we're now seeing with, like, turmoil over the Straits of Hormuz and a lot of economic uncertainty in the world, America's could be one bond crisis away from, like, the edge of bankruptcy. Right now, interest rates are pretty low. They're under 4%. Congress wants to make sure they stay under 4% for government borrowing. But they, during the Carter administration, like, Treasury bonds got up to 18% back during the OPEC embargo. And now we're seeing very similar circumstances with this Iran embargo. So if you were to see 18% bond yields tomorrow, it won't happen tomorrow, but if you, theoretically, if you were to see an 18% bond yield tomorrow, America would already be spending a 100% of its tax revenue just on the interest on its national debt. So that just really just highlights what a huge national curse that $39 trillion in debt is. And then one other story, just to highlight the influence of some of these radical forces against Western civilization. They did a survey in Britain. I don't know how representative it is. They surveyed 2,200 people and then in general to get a, and then about 1,000 Muslims in particular, and then found that actually the majority of Muslims in Britain, and there's quite a few of them, actually support Vladimir Putin's Russia, Communist China, and the Islamic Republic of Iran more than they support the United Kingdom. And so I think this is a really significant data point in the debates over immigration Britain's having right now, is there's been a huge spike in the Muslim population, and they're not assimilating into British society to the point where, like, they're looking at reprehensible regimes like China and Russia and the Islamic Republic and saying that their personal values align more closely with those regimes than they do with British values.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. And that actually does bring me to something I wanted to bring up, applying to Britain, Australia, and also Europe, is the way that Iran has mobilized its links to Muslims around the world. Since we recorded our show last week, the Netherlands experienced three high-profile Islamic terrorist attacks. So on March 13th, Rotterdam synagogue was hit with an explosion, when and four teenagers were arrested soon after that. Then during the Sabbath, you had an explosion at a Jewish school in Amsterdam. March 15th, Bank of New York's office complex in Amsterdam's financial district were hit. This is just in the Netherlands. We've had attacks on synagogues and on Jews around the world. We've had some attacks in Canada. I doubt this is Iran's full capability. We mentioned they're holding back with the Houthis. I think this is something that they're potentially holding back on, or that they could do a lot more here than they are doing. But it's an important element to keep watching, and shows the way that you know, we talk about Iran as being the king of the south, and we emphasize that it's that the king of the south in Daniel 11 is radical Islam led by Iran, and they have deep roots around the world. Another way that we saw this is from what we saw in Australia. The Australian Prime Minister, I mean, we've been pretty critical, I think rightly so, on this show of Anthony Albanese. He's been weak and cowardly when it comes to standing up for Israel and standing up to radical Islam. He has held Israel up to standards that no other country in the world is held to. He has issued all kinds of condemnations that are completely unjustified. And it was his even, I was going to say turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism, but in many ways even encouraging of anti-Semitism, that then led to you having this Bondi Beach terrorist attack in Australia. But even that weakness, even that cowardice is too strong for America, for Australia's Muslims. He was having a visit, I guess, connected with Ramadan to Australia's biggest mosque, and he was heckled, and there were reports that he was hounded out. He said, well, no, that didn't happen, but you had lots of, he was called a putrid dog, a genocide supporter. In previous years, the prime minister, when he's gone to this mosque, has addressed it. He was told, nope, you've just got to sit and listen. And I think he was so weak and enthralled to Australia's Muslim community that he meekly did as he was told. He did, yeah, I'll just come and listen. I'm not going to give a speech. And that's the situation there. He was condemned for shaking hands with Israel's president, President Herzog, after the Bondi Beach massacre. Like, these are pretty extreme people. If shaking hands with the Israeli president after Jews is massacred is too much for them, and it means that they'll just completely lose it. So they're there in Australia. That's a potentially massive problem building there. Here in the UK, a lot of discussion today is focused on Muslims praying publicly in the streets. They're planning a big celebration for Monday evening, again, as part of Ramadan festivities, where they're going to basically take over Nelson's Column, Trafalgar Square, you know, the very heart of London, and they'll have their prayer mats out. The call to prayer will go out, which proclaims Islam as being the only true religion, and that will be happening at the heart of London. And there's been a lot of talk this week again about how pathetic Sir Keir Starmer's response has been, and how he has really refused to support President Trump. There's been some, Mr. Stephen Flurry spoke about this powerfully on the Trumpet Daily this week. I'd encourage you to go back and look at that. And this is directly connected to that story with Muslims taking over London. Like, he is afraid to confront Iran and afraid to even be seen giving any support to America and confronting Iran because of what that would do to the Muslim vote. Our countries are being weakened from within by this mass immigration and by large numbers that are not just Islam or come from Islamic countries, but have quite extreme versions of this and want, you know, public worship or condemn a prime minister for even just memorializing victims of a terrorist attack. The other story from Europe that I think is important to touch on is the way that President Trump put out the call to help defend the Strait of Hormuz. And this is, like Andrew mentioned, Strait of Hormuz, this is a more significant choke point for Asia and then secondarily for Europe than it is for the United States. Yes, the global oil price is going to affect America, but that oil coming through the Strait of Hormuz isn't really going to the United States of America. So President Trump put out the call, and the answer was basically no. And I think it was led by, in a lot of ways, Germany. France, they were kind of more receptive. Like, yeah, we'll go for this. And then kind of backtracked. Germany, they were relatively pro the war initially. And then they really put the brakes on, saying, nope, we're not going to help patrol the Strait of Hormuz. And I say relatively pro the war. They were more supportive of America than some European countries. It was still pretty limited support. In this case, I don't think it's just Europe being pathetic in the same way that Britain has. They've responded really strongly to Cyprus. They do have the military resources. They do have the ability to send an armada somewhere. If you're France in particular, they have the ability to send a nuclear aircraft carrier somewhere. Unfortunately for France, this just amused me, we know exactly where that nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is because some French sailor was doing laps around the deck and had his smartwatch upload his progress to the internet, and you can now track where his workout has been and see exactly where in the Mediterranean this ship was while he was working out. Bit of a security flaw there, but the point is Europe has the ability to send a lot of ships on short notice. They're not doing it. And it's part of exactly what was on the cover of our Trumpet magazine last issue. The world is turning against America, and if America calls for help, they're not interested. Very much this is America's problem. And it shows this divide between Europe and America that even when, okay, like I do have some sympathy, Europe, they weren't consulted, they didn't cause this problem, but America is dealing with a threat that, I mean, Iran is a lot closer to Europe than it is to America. They've issued threats on Europe. They've carried out attacks on European soil. And you know, Europe is completely sitting this one out. So that really does put the disagreement with the United States very much on display. And again, we have an article, Does Germany Still Have a Secret Strategy to Destroy Iran? That talks about just that divide and the fact that dividing from the United States, disagreeing with the United States, plotting to bring down the United States is more important to Germany than bringing down Iran is at this stage. So that's an update, I think, covers how this war has affected the European perspective, the big highlights from the Middle East, how it's impacted the United States. We'll go now to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques. And Jeremiah, I think you wanted to focus this week on what we've learned about Russia's support for Iran.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. Russia has really increased its defense aid to Iran and its intelligence sharing with Iran as well, which is making a difference in empowering the Iranian forces there to better attack U.S. forces. This was reported in the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, based on testimony from U.S. officials who are familiar with the situation. And it shows that one of the main things that the Russians are giving the Iranians is components for modified Shahid drones. The Shahid, it is an Iranian drone, but the Iranians have been providing Russia with tens of thousands of these drones over the last 4 years to help Russia kill Ukrainians. And now Russia's in a good position to repay the favor. Russia has actually started to make its own variations of the Shahid in recent years, and they've improved navigation and targeting systems and communication systems. So now we have a situation where Russia is selling Iran components from these improved Shahids. And then Russia is also drawing from its battlefield experience with the Shahid. You know, Russia has used these in a very hands-on way, tens of thousands of them, as I said, for several years now, and they've acquired quite a lot of know-how. And so now Russia is giving Iran advice and technical information about optimal altitudes for flying certain kinds of attacks, and also about the number of drones needed to best execute certain types of attacks and things like that. So all of that is very valuable to Iran. And then Russia has also been providing satellite imagery directly to Iran. This has helped Iran to strike specific U.S. assets in the region, including a high-value early warning radar system in Jordan and some similarly high-value equipment in Bahrain. And it looks like Russia also played a role in the death of the 6 U.S. servicemen who were killed in a strike in the opening days of the war. So Russia is really helping Iran in some meaningful ways, and that's partly just because, you know, Russia loves to see America bleeding and just suffering in any way it can. And it's also because Russia benefits specifically in some ways from prolonging this war. First of all, Western nations are less able to assist Ukraine if they're focused on the Iran war. And then the war is also really driving up global prices of oil, as we've spoken about. Anyone who has filled up a car recently knows all about that. And it's terrible for our wallets, but oil is the lifeblood of the Russian economy. So these increasing oil prices are a real boon to Russia, and at a time when they are in dire need of some economic injection. Now, the United States, it's interesting because the U.S. has really downplayed the significance of Russia's assistance to Iran. It seems that President Trump is always trying to find a way to give Russian President Vladimir Putin a pass on everything. Putin is the one person who Trump never really criticizes, it seems. So it's no surprise, I think, to see President Trump saying it's no big deal for Putin to be helping Iran kill Americans and destroy U.S. assets. But this is actually quite a significant series of decisions that Putin's Russia is making here. And it shows the potential for Iran to weather sustained assaults and to exert outsized influence and force, I think, force that is perhaps well beyond what the U.S. and Israel have expected. And this assistance might help Iran punch above its weight for longer than American voters will be willing to tolerate. So we don't know exactly how all of this will shake out, but whatever happens, and whether it is due to Russian backing or other dynamics, biblical prophecy shows that the current war on Iran will not result in Iran's radical regime being eradicated. We've got an article that takes a close look at the Bible prophecies proving that. It's by Trumpet managing editor Joel Hilliker. It's called "Is Iran's Regime Finished?" So for anyone who would like to understand why Iran's regime will not be defeated, as sad as that is to hear, I hope you'll check out that article. It's called "Is Iran's Regime Finished?"
Great. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. There has been a lot of talk, I guess, with how these two conflicts intersect this week. There's been talk of the lessons that need to be learned from Ukraine in terms of intercepting drones, and even that America potentially could do more to learn from how Ukraine has dealt with Russian drones. So it's interesting to see. I mean, we've talked about Ukraine as being kind of a battlefield of the future, and a lot of countries very focused on what is happening so they can learn about what war looks like under these modern conditions. And now the Iran war is really turbocharging that. It'll be interesting to see whether, I don't know, whether people even try harder to learn from what's happening in Russia and Ukraine after all of what's gone on.
It's a fascinating point. Yes, it seems that everyone except for President Trump is interested in finding out what Ukraine has learned and putting that to use. He would rather use $3 million Patriot missiles to intercept Iranian drones than to ask for some help from Ukraine to use very cheap drones instead to intercept those Iranian drones. So we'll see if that changes, if the economics of it begin to make him a little bit more open-minded. It's hard to say.
Well, thanks for that. I guess we also saw Donald Trump sitting down with Japan's new prime minister and making some interesting jokes about Pearl Harbor. So what else did you have for us from Asia this week?
Yes, that's right. There was the meeting there yesterday in the White House between Takayuichi and President Trump. And you're right, that was a joke made in poor taste, I think. But the Japanese are quite understanding. For the most part, I think this was a very positive visit that deepened the U.S.-Japan alliance. They even moved forward with a $500 billion energy agreement. So that's a major boon to both economies, that agreement there. But then I also wanted to talk about a report about China and its plans to invade Taiwan. For years, U.S. analysts have said that China's invasion of Taiwan is imminent. It's only a decision away. It could happen anytime. But yesterday, the U.S. Office of the Director of National Intelligence published a new report saying it looks like China does not plan to carry its invasion out in the months ahead or even in 2027. From their point of view, China is now putting more effort into peaceful unification with Taiwan instead of using force. There are also, of course, limitations on China's military right now, especially in light of some pretty dramatic leadership purges that we've discussed on the show before. And China has been also very humbled, I think, to see the performance of some of their weapon systems in Venezuela that were supposed to be protecting Maduro, and weapon systems in Iran that have not been functioning very well. So China now appears to be trying more carrot and less stick with Taiwan. And maybe China will somehow convince the Taiwanese into being absorbed, or maybe China just needs a little bit more time to build its military up to a point where it can accomplish this incredibly difficult amphibious invasion across 100 miles of ocean. You know, if Russia's invasion of Ukraine seems like it was more complicated than the aggressor thought in that dynamic, this Chinese plan for Taiwan would be exponentially more so. So it does make sense that China would want to make sure that its forces are prepared for this momentous task. But however it happens, and whatever the timeline may be, we do expect China to eventually assert control over Taiwan.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Thank you to all of our panelists and to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production today. I'll leave you by just encouraging you to sign up for our latest, for our Trumpet Print subscription. Jeremiah mentioned there the article from Mr. Hilliker, and there's a lot more on along those lines in our latest Trumpet print. The cover, I've got the draft in front of me. I think the final edition goes to the press today with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei on the cover. Special report, what's next? Items include World War III will start with Iran, real hope for Iran's oppressed, will America win, the limits of war tech, shockwaves, the regime is dug in, foretelling Iran's rise and fall. This is your guide to understand what is happening here. And if you sign up on our website, thetrumpet.com, you'll be sure to get your own free print copy through the post. And yeah, you can sign up at any time. It's not a limited time offer or anything like that. We're never going to start charging you. It is free. It is always free. We just ask you to renew your subscription once a year just to confirm that you're still interested, that you're still receiving these. But if you do sign up in advance of it going to the printers, you'll get your print copy. Whereas if you wait for it to go up on the website and then you sign up, you'll get the next edition, but not that one that is this Iran special issue. So watch out for that. You can read it all online as well. And we really do a lot more effort, a lot more focus goes into those print edition articles. We really do work very hard to make this the best that they can be. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We will have another update from from our Canadian correspondent, Mr. Abraham Blondeau, next week. If all goes well, who knows? We might have another massive event blow up, but that's the plan. That'll be out on Wednesday. Until then, keep watching your world.